So I'm Rick Hansen, and this is Wednesday, November 20th, 2013. And my recorder is definitely on, so I'm always happy about that detail. And what I really want to do tonight is start a series of talks and discussions about the neuropsychology of the Four Noble Truths in Buddhism. I'm going to be in town, thank goodness, for about 2 months straight, and I'm going to do a series of presentations and talks about the Four Noble Truths starting tonight, and we're just going to take our time with this, especially the idea of, you know, the evolutionary neuropsychology of the Four Noble Truths. So tonight kind of kicks it off. This is a good chunk of material for anyone. It's also a good introduction to the fundamental foundations of Buddhism and Buddhist practice and perspectives. So if you want to bring friends along or encourage people to check it out in the weeks to come, you know, this would be a pretty good one, you know, for people, I think. Okay, so knowing that we have some time with this, not just tonight, but a series of presentations, and I'll post the talks from each one of these so that if you want to go back and re-listen to something, you can, and so forth. Knowing that we have some time with this, we're going to kind of unpack it and open it up and spread it out. So that's the larger context. You know, it's said in Buddhism that the essence of wise view or right view, which is the beginning of the Noble Eightfold Path, is some understanding of the Four Noble Truths. So we're going to explore these Four Noble Truths, and we're going to start with the first one tonight, the Noble Truth of Suffering. So hopefully this will not be too painful to explore the noble truth of suffering. So I want to read you a little bit of a passage here from one of my favorite Buddhist books. You know, if you're stuck on a desert island, this is a good one. It's called In the Buddha's Words. It's kind of like the Buddha's greatest hits, you know, translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi with some commentary to kind of string it together. And these texts in the original foundational teachings of the Buddhas in the so-called Pali Canon, Pali being the language of early Buddhism, the canon being a collection of teachings, these texts were handed down orally for centuries. So, you know, who knows what kind of distortion entered into them and also contributions of other people before they were finally written down in a form that was at all enduring, probably minimally several hundred years after the Buddha passed away. Still, there are best guess for what he actually thought and taught and meant. And they come to us, for the way I at least listen to them, they come to us across 2,500 years, 25 centuries, from people living in a time very, very unlike our own, an agrarian time, pre-literate. There was very little writing in that time, pre-industrial. And still, there's something so human and so psychological and so down to earth in these teachings. So I'm going to read you here a little bit of a passage, and you might also enjoy kind of the flavor. This is a sacred text, so it has some of that feeling to it in its rhythms. And yet the invitation always, 2,500 years ago and over the last 2,500 years, and certainly tonight, is to see for yourself what actually rings true for you, you know, what you actually think for yourself. So here it goes. This is a section where one of the Buddha's primary, two primary sort of teachers, students, if you will, Sariputta, is asked to talk about the essence of the teaching as he understands it. So he says here, let's see how to put it. Someone asks him, how can someone arrive at a deep understanding of the teaching of the Buddha? And he says, when, friends, someone understands suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering, in that way, this person has right view and has arrived at this true Dhamma, Dhamma or Dharma being the truth of things. So we have here these four elements, the Four Noble Truths. And what is suffering? What is the origin of suffering? What is the cessation of suffering? What is the way leading to the cessation of suffering? Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, illness is suffering, death is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair are suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. In brief, the five aspects of the mind, the five aggregates, so-called, the bare sensation of materiality, second, the sense of our experience as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, that's the second aggregate, the third aggregate being perception, some understanding of what things are, labeling it, this is a banana, this is a stick, this is a rope, this is a snake. That's perception, the third aggregate. The fourth aggregate is called the volitional formations, which really includes all the other contents of mind, thoughts, desires, emotions, longings, joy, sorrows, and all the rest. And then the fifth aggregate is awareness itself. Next time we meet, I'm going to talk more about the aggregates and how they get involved in the causes of suffering. So that's what they're referring to here. And then the second noble truth, what is the origin of suffering? It is this craving that leads to renewed existence, accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight here and there. That is, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, and craving for non-existence. This is called the origin of suffering, the second noble truth. And what is the cessation of suffering? The third noble truth. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving. The giving up and relinquishing of it. Freedom from it. Non-attachment. And fourth, what is the way leading to the cessation of craving? Leading to the cessation of suffering. It is just this noble eightfold path. That is, right view, right intention, right action, right speech, right livelihood, right mindfulness, right effort, and right concentration. This is called the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So there's a lot of ancient language there and a lot of terminology that, you know, it helps to kind of unpack and understand what it actually means, and we'll take some time doing that. But to really bring it down to earth here, I want to say, first of all, that if you step back and consider the Four Noble Truths, it's unlikely that the Buddha woke up from his night of enlightenment, you know, walked away from the Bodhi tree, bumped into some of his friends who were fellow renunciates and said, by the way, I've thought of Four Noble Truths. You know, just modern scholarship doesn't really think it exactly happened that way. If you have an opportunity to read in the Pali Canon, the Buddha's, you know, as best we can gather, own account of his own enlightenment and what happened to him. It was beyond words in some sense, as all profound awakening is ultimately. And there was some way in which, though, afterwards, as he attempted to boil it down for people, as he committed himself to a teaching career, he wasn't entirely sure he wanted to teach. He didn't set out to become a teacher. He set out to become awakened. Right? And then even afterward, he wasn't so sure he wanted to really take on the role of being a teacher, but people asked him to teach, as best we gather. So in response to that, you know, he probably was looking for some way to pull it together. And also, if you think about it, as Buddhism spread, he needed to have some fairly organized way for other people to teach his teaching. Again, this is an oral tradition, so he was looking for some kind of structure or way in which people could go out and they would teach Buddhism, you know, his way, not the way of somebody else. So that's probably some of the origin of the Four Noble Truths, to put it in historical context in the light of modern scholarship. Second, the framework, if you just kind of look at it, it has to do with processes and causes, right? Suffering is seen as a process, and there are causes of this suffering. Right? Now, one more point here is really kind of important in terms of understanding this stuff. One way to understand these Four Noble Truths, right? There is pain, there is frustration, there is disappointment, there is anxiety, there is sadness, there is feeling hurt, there is feeling inadequate, there is suffering broadly defined. We can understand that in purely psychological terms. We can also understand the causes of this suffering as, you know, resisting what's unpleasant, grasping after what's pleasant, clinging to what's heartfelt, and being kind of ignorant, if not deluded, about the whole mess, right? We can see that that is craving, in a sense, causes suffering. We can think of that also psychologically. We can think of the end of craving, the third noble truth, also in purely psychological terms, very conventional, secular terms, in other words, as a gradual falling away of drivenness or fear and anger or, you know, heartache, et cetera, et cetera. We can think of it in purely psychological terms. And we can also think of the Noble Eightfold Path in psychological terms. It's also the case that, as best we can gather, the Buddha's framework, his frame of reference, his cosmology involved reincarnation. It involved the notion that what led to the ongoingness of suffering included a kind of craving or desire for continued existence, future existence, and that the end of suffering, to some extent, involved developing oneself so fully that there were no longer any more causes of continued existence. Now, you don't have to understand or think about Buddhism in this more, if you will, cosmological way. But that was the framework in which the Buddha operated, right? And there are certain passages that don't make a lot of sense unless you understand that, in part, he's talking about the forces that lead people to have, in his view, life after life after dreary life, okay? But we can take it, if we want, strictly in terms of this particular life, and then see for ourselves, you know, what's true or not true in the Buddha's psychological analysis of our own suffering and its end. Okay? Great. So, why are the truths noble? What's noble about suffering, right? It's interesting to ask that. They're noble because they're profound. You know, really looking squarely, especially in our quite hedonistic culture, at the ubiquity of suffering, the inevitability of pain or loss, the reality of everyday discontent. You know, as Thoreau put it a couple hundred years ago, most people lead lives of quiet desperation. To really see that squarely, to see it in ourself and to see it in other people, and to also see and face the causes and to engage these causes, they have a kind of profundity to them, right? And as some modern translations have shown or suggested, perhaps the Buddha didn't really mean that these were noble truths, but more exactly, he meant that these were ennobling truths, that they ennobled those who grappled with them. And thinking back in his time, of course, to be noble or ennobled in this very patriarchal and feudal structure, right, in which he was a Brahmin himself and in which there was a clearly emerging social strata, right? And it was a good thing to be noble, and it was a good thing to become ennobled. And in part, what he's doing in his own teaching is a radical rebuke to the kind of stratified society of his time that said that to be noble, all you had to do was be born a Brahmin. In other words, you didn't have to earn it. What he said was that, no, it's not being a Brahmin that makes you noble. What makes you noble is really engaging the facts on the ground of human existence from the inside out and looking squarely at our suffering, subtle and gross, and then taking responsibility from the inside out to understand its causes and gradually undo those causes and gradually grow other causes like wise view, wise intention, loving kindness, moral commitments, concentration, et cetera, et cetera, that would lead to the gradual cessation of craving and suffering itself. That's what was ennobling, right? That's what made people, whether they were untouchables or Brahmins, men or women, householders or monastics, that's what made a person truly noble. We have that opportunity to become ennobled ourselves through our own practice. You know, the Buddha said, take gladness in your goodness. And appreciating the nobility, in a sense, the ennobling that's involved in genuine practice, genuine engagement with suffering and its causes and the end of those causes. You know, to me, that's a very beautiful thing. It's a very feeding, fulfilling kind of thing, and it keeps us motivated toward the high road over the lower one. The other thing about it is this idea that these are truths. And a truth is something that's general and perennial. In other words, it isn't just for one person or one situation. It's a broad way it is, as it were. And so his assertion is that, you know, these are broad universal truths and there's no escape from them. There are no exceptions. It's not like you get a pass. Like, oh, well, I don't want to be subject to suffering. Or, oh, I want to evade the law of gravity. I want to evade the law, as it were, that craving leads to suffering. Right? Nope. Sorry. Now, this is his view. But the other side of it about a truth is we get to decide ourselves what we think is true. As he affirmed and really said, it's not about authority. He didn't make arguments from authority. He basically said, ehi passiko, see for yourself. Judge for yourself, pragmatically, what leads to suffering, your own suffering, or what you can see in other people, and what leads to its end. Okay. So that's the framework here of, you know, I've listed so far now the Four Noble Truths, right, and kind of created a bit of a frame. And before I go into the dreary truth of suffering, I thought I would do a little thing here to kind of resource ourselves for this grim encounter. Actually, I think an ennobling and ultimately joyful encounter. But before I do that, I want to see if there are any questions or comments so far. Yeah, please.
If you cultivate the end of the causes of suffering, do you end suffering?
That's the Buddhist theory. If you cultivate the causes of the end of suffering, you end suffering.
So now,
that's correct. That's great. See, you got it. Aren't you? You're ennobled already. That's fantastic. Now, there are a few little caveats and hitches, and that's why we're going to take a little time with this, you know. To kind of preview some points I'll make, there's a fundamental distinction between inescapable physical and, as well, emotional discomfort in this life. In other words, the Buddha described having back pain after his awakening. And toward the end of his life, apparently he got food poisoning, and it was very uncomfortable, right? So if we have a body, we're still going to experience burning if we put our hands on a stove. And so in that sense, there's no escape in this life from that kind of pain. This is where the cosmological argument comes in. Because if we're truly to be ultimately free from all kinds of suffering and this sort of inescapable physical and arguably emotional discomfort is included under the general heading of suffering, the various lists that are given that I'll read pretty soon, the question then becomes, you nailed it. Is it actually possible to come to the end of all suffering, right? And the Buddha's argument, and I think that's a very interesting question. And one way to answer the question is, well, in a sense, if every single, including the most subtle aspects of craving, come to an end, there will be no rebirth. And if there's no rebirth, there are no more hot stoves. And in that ultimate sense, the cessation of craving would lead to the end of suffering. And that's where the element of rebirth comes in. And in the Buddha's own statements, at least as best we know of his own awakening, he said, as he got up, you know, or as he reported on it, he said, I knew at that point that what needed to be done had been done, and there would be no more rebirth. You know, he said, I saw countless of my own births, of various kinds. I saw countless births of others, and at the end of my awakening, all the causes had been quenched. You know, the traditional metaphor is one of either the ending of the nutriments that feed the craving that continues the cycle of suffering, including birth by birth by birth, or the meaning of the word nibbana, nirvana, the flame was extinguished. The causes of the ongoing flame had ended. There was no more fuel for the life to burn. He was going to play out a natural life. He wasn't going to kill himself. He lived a long time, actually, particularly considering his era, probably into his late 70s or early 80s. But in that framework, which you don't have to buy if you want to stay entirely inside a secular or naturalistic framework, but in his framework, the one way in which the end of craving led to the utter end of any kind of suffering, including the suffering of putting your hand on a hot stove, right, or the suffering of old age, disease, and death, you know, the inescapable physical pains of the body, let's say, is that his epitome of practice undid all the possible causes of rebirth. Okay. Now, down here on planet Earth, right, in a more conventional kind of sense, like we don't have to go all the way there, but what we can explore is the distinction that's often made in modern Buddhist thought and teaching, given in the saying, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. Right? If we make the distinction that I'm going to get to shortly between what the Buddha called the first and second darts of life, the first dart being unavoidable, inescapable, inevitable, physical, and emotional discomfort, and distinguishing between that and all our reactions to it. And it's very clear that in this life, as craving in its various forms, which I'll get to in future talks, falls away, we stop throwing those second, third, fourth, and fifth darts ourselves. We're able to engage the unpleasant, the pleasant, the heartfelt, and the neutral without tipping into craving about it and thus suffering and harm. And that's the possibility. So the good news, the Buddha was called the happy one. You know, the good news is that there is an end to suffering. And there is a way leading to that end. And it is ennobling to engage this. That said, you know, like the Buddha was also likened to a doctor, a physician. You know, we must begin with naming the illness itself. We must face the symptoms. The doctor must face the symptoms. What's actually going on here? Signs and symptoms, all right? And then the second noble truth, in effect, is the diagnosis, right, of the cause of the disease. Oh, craving. And then the third noble truth in this medical model, if you will, is you know, a very hopeful statement that there is a cure, the end of craving, cessation of craving. And then the fourth noble truth, in effect, is the treatment plan, right? The eightfold elements. That's a common metaphor as well, right? Okay. All right. Good. I'm glad we're going to take our time with this. All right. So throw my thing away. Good. Yeah, please, right there. Yeah. Yeah, please. Yeah, I think that's a great question. And so right view in the Noble Eightfold Path boils down to a deepening comprehension from the inside out of the Four Noble Truths. So right view is what we're talking about tonight. And so to bring it down to earth and to kind of, for me, preview a very important point, I'll just do it like this. The first noble truth involves, in a very intimate way, facing our own suffering. It means really opening to and telling the truth about, and being ennobled in the process, our own first darts of life, the physical pains in the body, the in my view, unavoidable social or emotional pains, since we're profoundly social animals, of worrying about others we love, or losing others we love, or facing the prospect of losing others we love, you know, to just open to that. And also to be increasingly aware of what we may have warded off or suppressed or disowned in terms of our own sense of stress or weariness or frustration or disappointment. You know, to have the courage and, if you will, the nobility to actually face and tell the truth about our own suffering, broadly defined, our own stress, our own discontent, our sense of this is it about life, the irritations of everyday life, and even subtler forms, you know, the sense of ick at life being so transient somehow, right? That's the first noble truth right there. To kind of own our own, what's it like to be me, and the ways it's hard. The Buddha didn't say there is only suffering. He just said life includes suffering. Right? He and others seemed to say that every moment must contain some suffering, amidst other things as well, perhaps. And in later weeks, I'll talk about why I think that's actually true, even though it annoys me as a 7 in the Enneagram that there's an inherent kind of discomfort or suffering, subtle or gross, in animal life altogether. But on the other hand, it doesn't mean that there's only suffering. Okay. The other takeaway from all this is to see the suffering in others. That too is an ennobling truth. You know, I do this little thing sometimes, like before I give a talk, you know, I'll just kind of scan the room and feel into, without trying to mind read, but feel into the weariness or stress or longing in the face of other people. You know, you can, in anyone's face, basically, this side of complete enlightenment, I think, you can see their suffering. You can see it in my face. You can see it as you walk down the street, you know, the faces in the crowd. And with intimates, to be open to their suffering and not turn away from it. You know, that too is a real way to engage the first of the noble truths. It's very, very powerful. So to me, that's one aspect of a really engaging right view. And then as we go forward in here, I'll talk more and more about these things, to really kind of watch how suffering rises and falls as a process, and also watch the causes of that process. Like I said, the Four Noble Truths are a framework of processes and causes, right? So what happens when we take things personally? What happens when we react intensely with alarm to something that's unpleasant? These are various forms of the second noble truth, the craving. And then also what happens when we lighten up? The third noble truth, when we take things so less seriously, we don't get so upset about them, when we hold them in a bigger perspective, when we don't take things so seriously. That's the third noble truth right there. And then what happens when we practice? You know, that, boom, do that, and you do, I know. You're really engaged in this process. You're really engaged in right view. Okay, another person? Someone, one of you over there? No? Okay, good, how about you?
I'm an Al-Anon participant, and since I've been coming here and reading your information, and the two of them together somehow, this morning I was so upset at the computer because of changing from iGoogle to Yahoo. Is
man, I'm with you.
Yeah. Anyhow, so just so upset. An hour I spent.
Computer dukkha, that's right.
And then I did my energization exercises that I used to teach.
Yeah.
And there's something happened. I have never felt such utter contentment in all my life. I don't, you know, it's like, whoa. How could I go from such intense, you know, suffering, I guess, to utter contentment? And I know that my dog has a lot to do with this. I have a tiny little dog, and I just adore him.
Yeah.
And but I have never, ever felt such contentment.
Well, I'm so happy for you.
And, you know, just,
yeah, that's great.
I don't know how this all fits in into this, but it's all, I know that what you're doing is helping me.
Oh, I'm glad about that. I'm grateful for you saying that.
Especially one thing that all of us are hardwired. That somehow, to me, has been the greatest relief.
That we're inclined toward negativity often.
That all of us.
Yeah, all of us are. It's not a unique character flaw on your part, which is a relief, isn't that right? It's great. Yeah, you're right. You know, if I could just jump into this, you know, Virginia Satir, the great family therapist, she would have people in workshops. Don't worry, I won't do this with you, but she would have people go around and bump into each other with their belly buttons, because we're all joined. We all have a belly button, right? And we're all joined, in some sense, by suffering. You know, that's part of our common humanity.
Yeah, the alternate to being relieved was to have the compassion.
Yeah.
It's both, you know. It's like,
that's
so
right.
Something wonderful is happening.
That's great. I'm glad for you. And you're naming an important, yay! You know, and maybe moving toward kind of an end for tonight, kind of as a placeholder, you're also naming a super important aspect to this, because to face our suffering, we have to have compassion, right? Otherwise, we just get overwhelmed by it. To face our distress or to face the suffering in other people, we need to have also some kind of warm-heartedness for ourselves, some sweetness for ourselves, also some sweetness for others, some wish that they not suffer. Otherwise, we're just left with a kind of hell realm. Right? Yeah. Oh, a kind of hell realm. Hell. Where it's like a hell, right? If all there is, you know, suffering our own and others, and there's nothing that lightens it up, etc., we're in deep trouble. So, yeah, one more person, then I'll kind of give you a preview of where I'm going next week.
I'm not sure exactly if you're able to answer this, but I know you're going to be talking about neuroscience. Some years ago, I was reading one of Eckhart Tolle's books,
Yeah.
And he said it just sort of keeps coming up and then it sort of goes away. And I noticed last night it was just in sort of a quiet, a little bit more painful state, you know, and I just stayed with it and fell asleep and hung with it. And I actually said to myself, this is something that somehow rises and can get stronger at certain times. And I'm not sure if that's true, if there's something neuroscientifically that says, like, there's a rhythm to these sort of sufferings we have. As well as the work we're doing on ourselves or what our practices are.
Yeah, that's probably a good segue, you know, to wrap tonight. In this continuous stream of material, I got through about halfway, third of the way through what I kind of thought I would do tonight, which is great, because it's great for me as a presenter to have time to do this. So I'll look for a little wrap here. So yeah, so Eckhart Tolle, to me, he's using a framework that's in terms of the pain body. You could think of it metaphorically. You could also think of it in some ways a little bit outside the conventional frame of Western science, you know. And I'm not disputing it at all. I mean, so I'm thinking about that. I want to introduce the notion of states and traits. And what I mean is that if you think about suffering and also the causes of it and the end of suffering, the cessation of the causes of suffering, you could think of it in terms of momentary thoughts or sensations or feelings, right, or desires or inclinations. Those are states. Or you can think of it more as traits, more as mood, like comparing the difference between a state of sadness and a mood or trait of depression. A state of worry compared to an ongoing trait of anxiety. say. Or you could say a momentary flash of irritation, or that's a state, or an ongoing trait of grouchiness or prickliness, or a momentary feeling of remorse, or feeling less than somebody else, not as good as, compared, that's a state compared to an ongoing trait of feelings of inadequacy or shame or worthlessness, right? You see the distinction between states and traits? I think that's a very useful way to think about different aspects of suffering broadly defined. For one, to become more aware of kind of the background atmosphere, the weather, if you will, of the mind as mood or trait. Because that's what really is very powerful. States come and go. But traits, it's like a weather system that just hangs around, you know. Flip the other way. We can have momentary positive states, you know, a moment of cheerfulness. And we can also have a gradual shift through practice of positive traits. And we start, our resting state starts moving more and more in a positive direction. So in terms of opening to the ennobling power of the First Noble Truth, opening to one's own suffering, I think it's helpful in terms of mindfulness to track the distinction between states of suffering and traits of suffering in oneself, and to be more motivated around and activated by and caring and kind and compassionate toward ourselves with regard to ongoing traits of suffering. You know, an ongoing mood that's subtly depressive or anxious or irritable or inadequate. The four great categories of negative states or emotions: anger, fear, sadness, and shame. Right? To be more aware, in other words, of traits or moods, if you will, including in other people. Not just taken for granted. Often we just kind of live in an ongoing mood of anxiety or irritation or inadequacy or sadness. And we just kind of take it for granted. It becomes the new normal. You know, the water we swim in, we don't know we're wet. So becoming more mindful of that, I think that's a takeaway. And then related to that, being aware of the relationship between states and traits. In other words, traits are built from states. Neurons that fire together, wire together, right? Experience-dependent neuroplasticity. What we routinely, you know, as the Buddha said, the mind takes its shape from whatever it rests upon routinely. If we routinely have states of anxiety or sadness or anger or shame, we're going to grow those traits inside us. If, on the other hand, we routinely have states of wise view or compassion or tranquility or happiness or taking gladness in our own goodness, right? If, or insight, or moral commitment, restraint, sila, virtue, if we routinely have those states, we're going to grow those as traits. And as we grow, on the one hand, if we grow negative traits foster negative states, which then become the beginning of deepening and reinforcing negative traits, especially given the negativity bias of the brain, which is very inclined toward converting negative states to negative traits. It's like Velcro for the bad, but Teflon for the good. It's not very efficient, the brain, at converting positive states to positive traits. Even though positive traits are built from what? Positive states. See the relationship? And that's a very powerful way to be aware of our suffering and to realize that as we engage the ennobling first truth of suffering, we are going to be aware of negative states, of suffering states, of anxiety or sadness or anger or shame or physical pain in the body. So how do we engage the truth of suffering without reinforcing traits of suffering? Right? Yeah. Good question. I agree. You know? So, and I think that's where mindfulness really comes in. That's where it makes all the difference in the world. If we're simply caught up in our negative state, neurons that fire together wire together. We're turning that state into a trait, right? On the other hand, if we're aware of a negative state or even a negative trait, by negative I don't mean bad, I just mean, you know, depressed or irritable or feelings of inadequacy or loss, etc. So if we engage a negative state or trait in a space of open awareness, if we step back from it, if we observe it, if we witness it, if we let it be, if we bring to bear the two great tools of the physician, light and air, if we do what the Buddha talked about often, disentangling, pulling apart the threads, tracking the various aspects of this momentary negative state, or the different features of an ongoing negative trait, if you will, some kind of trait of suffering. If we do that, we gradually associate untroubled, spacious awareness that's not craving, that's not suffering itself. We gradually associate that positive, open, spacious awareness to the negative content it holds, the momentary trait of the momentary state of suffering, or the more enduring trait that has to, of some kind of suffering. And then the combination of that, the holding an open, spacious awareness of our engagement with the truth of suffering, can gradually help undo that suffering. So that's a very important point as I invite you over this week to come to really face your own suffering. But to do that, you've got to hold it an open, spacious awareness or you reinforce it. Similarly, see the suffering in other people, but be able to be present with their suffering in a way that doesn't invade your mind and overwhelm you. Otherwise, you know, we're just reinforcing that negative state and turning it into a negative trait. Follow that? It's very profound and very powerful. And then to wrap up, because I got to wrap up, because I'm already 7 minutes over time and going to do that. You know, as they say in theater, right? Always, you know, leave them wanting more. But anyway, the takeaway here for you, if you could especially, is to also be very hopeful. Because as we get more and more into the Four Noble Truths, it's wonderfully hopeful because we have the power to cultivate wholesome states and then install them in the brain as wholesome traits. And then increasingly draw upon those as wholesome traits to the point that they increasingly activate automatically. Okay, you okay with this consideration? The Four Noble Truths, I'm going to wrap it up on this one. So if you could, I invite you to, as a way to face, you know, all this too, is think about refuge. In other words, what do you take refuge in? Because the truth is, to face our own pain, we need to be able to take refuge in some place where we can stand. And there are classic refuges, the teacher, the teaching, and the community of the taught. You can also take refuge, and I invite you right now, just take a moment, after all this kind of dreary consideration of suffering, what are you glad about in your life? Just taking a moment here. We'll kind of sit with the last minute here, if you could. Just opening to, okay, I get all this suffering business. Thanks a lot, Rick. But, all right, what am I grateful for?
You know? Give
yourself a little puppy. Yeah, a puppy. Okay, so let's sit quietly for a minute here as we end. And if you...
Next Wednesday is the day before Thanksgiving. Are you here?
Yeah, totally. We're here. We're rocking and rolling. And before the suffering of Thanksgiving, and man, you better come here. Okay.
Rick, is this being recorded?
Yep.
Yeah,
it's all recorded and it'll be posted on my website. And that you just go on my website where it says teaching, and I think it multimedia, and there's a section called audio. And you just go to talks and then go to Buddhist Wisdom, and all the talks are dated and they have a title.
But I mean, can you get a DVD or anything?
You just click
the
link.
Take it out of the computer?
Yeah, if you click the link, you can play it on your computer and download it to your computer.
Okay.
Yeah, and then you'll have it with you. That's great.
How soon do you put it?
This one will be put up really fast because I'm gonna send out an email on Sunday to my larger Bay Area list and tell people about this series I'm going to do and encourage people to listen to this particular talk. And if you're not on my email list for the sitting group, all you have to do is give me your name and email address. I'll never share with anybody. And there's a list over there on the table. Okay? I'm very heartened as a teacher that there's so much interest in suffering. It's good. You know, honestly, as a longtime seven in the Enneagram plus a guy and a guy, period, like suffering, are you kidding me? And one of the things that's been really powerful in my own practice is to really kind of investigate that first noble truth. It's the one people kind of name and go, and glide right by, you know? But there's a tremendous amount of growth and healing and freedom that's available in just considering what is suffering, and then why do we suffer, and how can I suffer less? Anyway, so as a refuge for this consideration, let's take a final minute here thinking about things that you feel glad about or grateful for. And remembering that in the week to come, if you like, the practice is to see suffering, broadly defined. Stress, pressure, worry, fear, ordinary pain, to see suffering in yourself and other people. And if you like, opening to being ennobled by the seeing. And remembering that the whole point is to suffer less. As the Buddha said, I teach only one thing, suffering and its end. That's the point. See you next week.